My ambition after that trip to the Highlands was simply to see if Tasmania could make a really good single malt whisky.
We don't expect everyone to like these wines, so yes, there's some risk.
Drink more sherry, because that's when you can really educate yourself on what happens in maturation.
The thing is with Australian natives, you put them in a gin, the aftertaste invariably is just bitter and unpalatable.
I think the Irish whisky landscape is going to be wildly different over the next 5 years.
This is the Drinks Adventures podcast. I'm James Atkinson, and this is the show where I speak to some of the world's most exciting producers of beer, wine and spirits, and uncover trends and issues in the drinks industry today.
We previously met Holly Clintworth on the Drinks Adventures podcast back in March 2021. So if you're keen to get the backstory on Holly's distillery, Bass and Flinders, head on back to that episode in Season 8. I've linked to it from the show notes. Holly's back with us having recently returned from a six-week internship in Cognac, supported by a Churchill Fellowship. The trip had the objective of learning the art of brandy production from leading cognac producers so that Holly could share her findings with the Australian distilling industry. I wanted to find out how Holly got on in this endeavour, and coupled with that, how she's settling into her dual role as president of the Australian Distillers Association. Holly has only been in the chair since November 2022 and has already had to deal with some contentious issues, like the misleading usage of the term single malt by some distillers, which I also discussed recently on the show with Tasmanian Whisky and Spirits Association President, Cam Brett. Holly and I also cover the divisive debate around base spirit in gin, fueled by a recent article in the mainstream media, and some controversy surrounding Australian distilleries and the San Francisco World Spirits Competition. That's all coming up in this interview with Holly. Well, Holly Clintworth, great to have you back on the Drinks Adventures podcast.
Thanks, James. Nice to be with you.
I suppose, first off, I should congratulate you for becoming president of the ADA. A great appointment, I think.
Thank you. Appreciate that. Yes, it's a very, very exciting time in the industry, actually. So I'm really enjoying the role so far.
Last time I spoke to you, which wasn't on the podcast, it was just a conversation that we had, you were telling me about your Churchill Fellowship trip to Cognac, which sounded really exciting. So I'm really, really keen to know how that went.
Yeah, it was incredible, actually. So I was lucky enough to be given a Churchill Fellowship, which allowed me to head to Cognac for 6 weeks earlier this year. It was just the most, I guess, fulfilling experience for me, because I have a real passion for reigniting Australia's love affair with brandy. You know, it's what my father's passion was when he first established Bass and Flinders way back in 2009 as well. So it's always been a passion of mine to learn more about brandy and improve our craft, and to have that opportunity, that time and that space to really just spend 6 weeks immersed in something that I love and learning from some of the world's best was just incredible.
You'd had already been before from memory. This was kind of probably a much more immersive, deeper dive.
Yeah, I'd been a couple of times before and it never felt like enough, to be honest. And both times I visited was in the off season, so they weren't distilling. And I always knew that I needed to get back there and be in amongst it all during the distillation season to really see what's going on. So I timed it around it being kind of towards the end of their distillation season. So their season kind of starts from October right through to they have to finish by the end of March. And it's a legal requirement that that happens. And that's controlled by the government organization called the BNIC. And that really comes down to quality control. I mean, it's an interesting organization in itself, but having those parameters around when you can and can't distill is very much around harnessing the ripeness of the fruit as soon as it's been harvested, getting that through the still, and capturing the essence of the wine into that spirit as quickly as possible. So
we don't have any laws like that in Australia around when you can distill, but how does it actually work in practice for you guys?
Naturally, we kind of do the same. So our Chardonnay is harvested around March, and so we'll start distilling kind of from the end of March, start of April, and we'll just be distilling until that's finished. And then as soon as that's done, we will start distillation of the Shiraz that we use for our gin. So similar thing, I guess. It just naturally you want to put the wine through the still as quickly as possible just to capture the freshness of the fruit.
And it has to be unsulfured from what I understand, which also sort of means that time's not on your side for, you know, waiting around to put it through the still. Is that correct?
Yeah, exactly right. One of the key learnings, I guess, from when I was in Cognac was around the importance of the wine. I mean, I've always known that you cannot add sulfur. It not only does it erode some of the copper in your still, but actually as you're kind of condensing the aromatic flavors and aromas as you turn wine into spirit, the sulfur can create some really terrible kind of egg aromas. So you certainly want to avoid it from quality perspective as well. So in Cognac, the grape variety that they use, 98% of the wine distilled is called Uni Blanc. And Uni Blanc is naturally very high in acidity. So using wine that has a natural high acidity is kind of that counteracting element to not using sulfur. Higher acidity tends to help preserve the wine for distillation.
And so I kind of cut you off there. You were going to go on to tell me about basically the experience from the point of view of being there during that crucial period.
Yeah, so obviously needed to go to Cognac to learn more about brandy distillation, the craft of brandy. You know, it really is the mecca when it comes to brandy. And, you know, the whole premise behind wanting to go there, Australia, as I said before, it really is in a very exciting time of craft spirits. And unfortunately, brandy, you know, probably since the 1960s, 70s had a bit of a fashion crisis, and there's not a lot of distillers making brandy, although I am coming across more and more producers who tell me, oh, look, I've put a barrel down here and a barrel down there just to see what happens. So I think there's definitely an interest in the industry. And I think there's also an awareness that we have such amazing wine regions in Australia. It's only natural for the industry to start to move in the direction of turning some of that leftover wine into great spirits. So the whole premise behind me going to Cognac was, obviously, we are brandy producers. I want to improve how we do things, but to also bring knowledge back from, you know, some of the world's best brandy producers, bring that knowledge back to Australia and share that with the industry as well, and improve our knowledge, because there really isn't anywhere to learn how to produce brandy in Australia at the moment. I had a contact at Courvoisier, and I had, and through my networks, I got in touch with a couple of other distilleries. So Francois from Mary Melrose, which is a tiny organic cognac producer, as well as Amy and Jean from Jean-Luc Pasquet. I was a bit anxious actually before I left, because they were all really, really busy, and they were just like, yes, of course, come over. You can work with us. We'll show you what we do. No problem. But trying to get any more out of them as to how my kind of 6 weeks would pan out, you know, I just had to kind of throw myself in the deep end, get over there and just, you know, go all in. So my 6 week kind of unfolded as I was there, and I was really lucky. I got to meet, you know, the master blender of Hennessy and the master blender of Rémy Martin. And, I went and had a meeting with the BNIC, which is that government body. And they talked to me about rules and regulations and their minimum quality standards. I met people at laboratories that do all the analysis of the eau de vie and the analysis of the wine. And they talked me through kind of the different chemical analysis that they do. I met a retired lecturer who used to lecture in production of cognac. So I think, you know, as I was there, more and more people would open up doors for me. But the one thing that impressed me was how open and willing they all were in sharing knowledge with me. And when I first spoke to Thibault of Courvoisier, you know, I said, well, look, I hope you don't think I'm coming to try and steal all your secrets. And he said, he said, no, of course not. You know, like, I think the interesting thing is in cognac, something like 3% of total cognac production is actually consumed in France and the rest is exported. So interestingly, the culture around consuming brandy in France is not dissimilar to what it's like in Australia. And therefore, in France and Australia, we have a similar challenge of trying to reinvigorate and reignite, you know, the local consumer's interest in brandy. And so,
because they drink a lot of scotch there, I think, in France, don't they?
They do drink a lot of scotch. And interestingly, a side note, some of the cognac distilleries are actually starting to produce some whiskey themselves because of that limitation on when you have to start and finish distillation of wine. And so they've realized they've got these assets there that they should be using in the off season to produce other products. So they're working on whiskey as well. But yeah, so, you know, everybody I met in Cognac, there was this real ethos of sharing and of helping me. And I think another key learning that I took away was we in Australia, I mean, we certainly shouldn't be trying to replicate Cognac. We cannot replicate Cognac. Cognac is Cognac. It is made in the region. It is made from certain grape varieties that don't grow here. Uni Blanc, you can't get in Australia. They've got very different environment, different terroir, all of that. So it's not about going to Cognac, bringing the knowledge back and trying to replicate what they do, but it's about going to Cognac, learning what they've learned over hundreds of years that they've been doing what they do, and taking the best of their knowledge and working out how to then apply that to the Australian environment. So, you know, they were very much like, here, I'll show you exactly what we do. I'll show you at what temperature we do the cuts and what parameters we work with. But even from distillery to distillery, it was different. And everybody thought their method was the best method. So my job was really to meet as many distillers as possible, get hands-on experience, and basically take some of those nuggets and those key learnings, bring that back, and just think about how we can apply that here in Australia to make uniquely Australian brandy.
Tell me about some of the key takeaways that you got. Was there anything where you were mind blown, wow, like, okay, I never thought of it like that, and this is something that's going to be really important for us in Australia to know?
So many things that I learned. I think, you know, for me, learning off my father, I used to ask questions of him. I'd say, oh, why do we do things this way? Why are you doing that? And he'd say, oh, just because, Holly, this is how we do it. This is what we like to do. This is how we make our brandy. And so being in Cognac and being able to ask, dig a bit deeper about the why, but also I think I've really realized just how important that vinification process is, as well as the barrel maturation. You know, I think up until now, I've been very focused on the distillation. You know, it really is right from the vineyard right through to the type of oak, the type of toasting that you choose. All of the distilleries set up in Cognac are gas-fired, and we have recently imported our own secondhand Cognac still, which is also gas-fired. We haven't yet commissioned it yet, but it will get commissioned shortly. And I found the concept of the way they manage their gas, the way they manage the heat and the fire at different points in the distillation, they call it the gas curve, and how important that gas curve is. So particularly on the second distillation, when you're doing the heads and the hearts cut, which are two of the most important times in distillation for kind of manipulating the flavors and aromas of your end spirit, they're controlling the gas and they're managing it to kind of slow the heat down, taper off that heat so that you can make cuts, and it's a bit of a slower flow coming out the parrot. What fascinated me about how they manage their gas curves is that it's derived from way back when it was a wood-fired pot still, when they were throwing wood onto the fire, and naturally when they put more wood on the fire, the heat would go up and it would be a stronger burn, and then it would slowly kind of burn off. And just through a lot of tradition, they've managed to work out how to moderate that heat and get the best out of that heat at different points in the distillation cycle to ultimately make the best spirit. I guess another thing that kind of blew my mind, we met with an oak specialist, and he very much explained kind of the chemical impacts of oak on spirit and how that all works. And I found one particular nugget really fascinating, where actually he was talking about firstly the difference between American oak versus French oak, and it's about this thing called tylosis. That is about how the oak manages kind of its flow of water and nutrients while it's alive. And then for American oak is very much watertight because of its chemical makeup. And so the charring of American oak is very much about breaking up that oak to allow it to breathe and allow more oxygen in. Whereas the French oak is naturally not watertight. And these kind of fibers that are in the French oak, they're almost like tubes, and it's all about the importance of making sure that you work with the grain when it comes to French oak, because if you're not working with the grain, those little tubes will eventually kind of leak out some brandy. And what I found really fascinating was when it comes to barrels and the use of barrels, it's actually only the tiny millimeters on the inside of the barrel that you're working with to extract that oak. And how that's actually working is where the intersection of the oak head and the staves intersect, there's a little opening where those tubes are exposed to the spirit. And it's through those tubes that spirit goes into those first few millimeters of that oak, if that makes sense. And it's just those millimeters where that interaction's taking place. And so I just found that pretty mind-blowing as well.
And so what's kind of next for the, you know, with the information that you've gathered, you've kind of spoken about sharing it with the local industry. So how will that kind of unfold?
I'm kind of 3/4 of the way there in writing my report, and my report has got a lot of technical detail in there, and it basically, you know, I've split it up by distillation, gas curves, cooling, cleaning, wine, chemical analysis, all of that. And so that, I think it'll probably be about a 50-page document in the end. I'll get that published and I'll share that with the industry. Obviously, door is always open if anybody wants to talk to me about what they're doing in the brandy space. And I guess the intention with that document is to lay out how they've been doing things in cognac and then try and overlay a bit of, you know, how can we apply this in Australia? And I think there's a lot more innovation and a lot more work that we can do. For instance, at Bass & Flinders, we only work with Chardonnay, but there's so many different grape varieties, so many different types of oak. There's just so much more that we can be doing to innovate in that space. And I think that's the really exciting thing about making brandy in Australia in comparison to what they do in cognac, because they do have those very strict parameters. And there's kind of two sides to the coin, because the benefit of that is they've got that minimum standard that is legislated, but at the same time they don't get to explore the same new varieties and oak finishes that we do.
Did you take over some of your wares for the distillers over there to enjoy?
I did. I proudly put our brandy on the table and I shared it around, and I was always interested to hear what they thought. And I think they were very unfamiliar with any kind of brandy that wasn't made from Uni Blanc. And so I think their mind was blown just in tasting something that was made from Chardonnay. We did have some long discussions about our barrel program and about, you know, the need to work in a bit of that new oak to give it that extra kind of depth, especially for our ochre, which is an older aged brandy, and also discussions around the fact that because we're distilling on lees and because the ochre is older, distilling on lees and working in of new oak are components that are really crucial, particularly for older brandies. So it was talking about our style and, you know, what we want out of our brandy, because everyone's got their own style, and how to kind of further enhance what we do, really. I mean, you don't want to come home and completely blow up everything that you do. That's not what I was there to do. It was just about learning what the best thing for our existing style is and how we can dial that up.
Co-partnership is different from other agencies purely because we specialise in drinks.
Co-partnership is a strategic branding and packaging design agency founded by Max Harkness and Zoe Green in 2011.
We're not just designers who happen to be specialising in drinks. We're already ahead on trends in market, consumer behaviours, understanding how drinks are made, understanding the nuances of every category.
Even if you don't know the name Co-partnership, you're familiar with their work on great brands that have featured on this podcast, like Morris, St Hugo, Kate Byron and Mr. Black.
Drinks design, we believe it really does require specialisation. There's some pretty technical things that happen throughout the process of really understanding how things are made and printed and which suppliers you need to go to get things done.
Co-partnership, a proud supporter of the Drinks Adventures podcast.
Branding and packaging, it's 50% of your success, really. I think it's going to be as important as the drink itself. If you get both the branding and the product right, then that's what's going to set you up for growth and momentum.
Visit co-partnership.com to get in touch with the team. Coming up next, we move on to Holly's work as president of the Australian Distillers Association. I started by asking Holly, what is her pitch to distillers who haven't yet joined the ADA, as I occasionally see comments from non-members on its Facebook page questioning the value of membership?
Yeah, look, I think, and I certainly see some of those comments as well, but, you know, the great thing I also see is the vast majority of those comments will pitch in and explain exactly why it's so beneficial to be a member. Look, I think we're always going to be stronger together. There's some really crucial conversations that we need to be having with the government, which we are starting to have, but we need to gain more traction around, you know, excise tax reform, greater support in jobs and skills and export opportunities. So the stronger we are as a combined and united voice, the better, particularly when we're having those kind of conversations with government. So I think that's the reason for wanting everybody to work together in a collaborative way for the better of the industry and the, for a sustainable future of the industry. But as far as value goes, you know, I think the Australian Distillers Association is the peak industry body. We do have a strong voice. We're also really dedicated to maintaining and protecting the integrity of our industry. You will have seen that, you know, we've put our stake in the ground when it comes to use of the term single malt recently. I think it's really important to have a body that helps guide and direct the industry and seeks support from government. And, you know, you can see how successful we've been already. Several years ago, we started out getting a $30,000 rebate in the excise tax area, and then that got lifted, and now that's a $350,000 remission scheme. And that's enabled a lot of distilleries, small distilleries like ourselves, Bass and Flinders, to reinvest in our business, to grow, to invest in our venue, invest in our innovation. And, you know, those kind of things don't happen quickly. So having an industry body in order to do that work and to get that support from government is vital. And then communicating changes to members, communicating how to manage your excise, how to be aware of all the legislative requirements, that is labeling integrity. And I think, you know, we're doing a lot of work in that space to help guide newer producers. So I guess, you know, when it comes to like the Facebook page, certainly there's members and non-members having conversations there, but we're always of the opinion that the door's always open to everybody. And the more people we can get onto that forum to have conversations, I think the healthier the industry is going to be, because we can share the right information and stamp out any misinformation.
It sounded like it was a pretty good outcome with those distilleries around the incorrect usage of the term single malt. They were both receptive, both those two distilleries were receptive to the issues that were raised by the ADA.
They were. Look, it's also not something that happened quickly, but I think they come around and they understand that using the term single malt in reference to a spirit that hasn't been aged for a minimum of 2 years, it ultimately is misleading to the consumer. I think consumers will intrinsically link the term single malt to whiskey, and they won't always be aware that what they're buying is not whiskey. And so ultimately, in understanding that, you know, the recommendation has since been to adopt the term malt spirit, and that is a long-held industry standard appropriate naming for such product.
The other issue that's been debated extensively, to say the least, recently is around the distilleries that are using neutral alcohol purchased, bought in, versus distilling it themselves. And there was an article last week about that that sort of kicked off more debate. I'm kind of sick of people talking about this, to be honest. I think you were very diplomatic in that article, because obviously Bass and Flinders has its reasons for making its own spirit. What are your thoughts on this debate? You know, do you think it's kind of been done to death a little bit, and it would be best for everyone to move on and focus on their own businesses?
Oh, yeah.
Putting words in your mouth there,
Holly. I think you hit the nail on the head there. You know, we're really proud of what we do. We're really proud of the fact that we make our spirit from scratch for our gins as well as our brandy. I'm also a big believer that, you know, you don't get ahead by cutting down other people. It's not about focusing on what everyone else around you is doing. I think that we take the approach of just focusing on what we do, promoting our point of difference and do it well. And the thing about that article, to me, it was really a non-story. I mean, it's so common in the industry for people to buy in neutral spirit, use that as a starting point, and then add their own unique botanical flavor profile to that and distill that into their own product. I think that story really didn't have that understanding that it's industry practice, common industry practice, both locally and internationally. You know, some of the world's biggest gin producers buy in that neutral ethanol as their starting point and then create their own incredible products from that. You know, it's a shame that particular journalist wanted to take that angle, and we certainly don't like to see articles like that convey this sense that there's any infighting in the industry, because it's just not true. I think the majority of producers work together. We're hugely supportive of each other. You know, there might be one or two out there that are on the sidelines, but it's our job as an industry body to bring them into the loop and actually suggest that they become a member so that we can also educate them as well.
Yeah, well said. One of the other pieces of news that's come out from the ADA recently is around spirits competitions. And I was quite curious about this particular statement where it says the president and chief executive have been in discussions with the organisers of, this was the San Francisco World Spirits Competition. They've raised concerns that several Australian distillers have contacted them, in some cases in threatening terms. Can you shed any light on what these distillers were sort of campaigning for or hoping to achieve? Because obviously that really doesn't put any of the industry in a good light.
Yeah, look, it's certainly a shame that some contacted the Tasting Alliance and San Francisco Spirits Competition and were a little bit threatening in their comments to them. I think ultimately we really respect what the San Francisco Spirits Competition does for craft spirits around the world. Bath and Flinders every year will submit our spirits to that particular competition. We have to cherry pick which ones we do support, but that's one of them. You know, it's a world renowned competition. So unfortunately, it seems like some of the producers that submitted their spirits weren't quite clear on the parameters around the definitions. You know, every spirits competition has their own parameters on what they define as being a small craft produced whiskey or a commercial whiskey. And I think at the end of the day, our stance is that producers need to conduct their own due diligence. If they don't appreciate or if they don't respect the way a particular spirits competition defines their categories, just don't submit your spirits. Just don't participate. So in the end, the San Francisco Spirits Competition contacted the Australian Distillers Association and just asked us to make it clear that if there were any questions and if there was anything that was unclear, they've got a team ready to answer questions around definitions and categories and how they run their competition. And we fully respect that, and we fully support how they do things.
I'm just kind of reading between the lines, and maybe this was partly sort of conveyed in the statement, but there was some confusion around perhaps some distillers seeing other Australian distillers entering product that they perceived was not commercially available in their eyes and therefore not eligible to be entered, when in reality the rules of the competition don't stipulate that it needs to be on the market. It just needs to be a commercial product produced by a commercial distillery that they want to enter into the show, even if it's not available for sale yet.
That's right. There was some confusion around that specific point around commercially available. And, you know, I've come across some competitions that require that you have enough spirit already bottled so that if/when you win a trophy, you can, you can supply a certain amount of your bottles to the awards night, for instance. Whereas other competitions, you can pull some spirit from a barrel and you can submit that. And if you win a gold medal, I have no doubt that that producer is going to take that spirit out of that barrel, bottle it, and sell it as an award-winning spirit. So, you know, those are some of the kind of nuances, and I think there was some misunderstanding there from some producers that submitted their whiskey to the San Francisco Spirits Comp.
What else are you currently working on with the ADA at the moment? I'm really disappointed that I wasn't able to come to the conference this year. I haven't been to one, actually, and it's definitely high time that I come along next year. So have you sort of started making plans around where that's going to be, for example, and what's going to be the plan for that?
Yes. You definitely have to come along to the next one, Jane. It'll be good to see you. I think, it never ceases to amaze me how, you know, these conferences, they get better and better each year and bigger as well. You know, we had over 500 attendees last year. But when I went to my first conference back in 2017, it was at Archie Rose, and there was probably only about 35 of us. So
500 this year, was that, sorry?
Yeah, 500. Yeah. Over 500.
So I think it started the weekend of my wedding, so I've got a pretty good excuse.
Yes, of course. You're excused. But yeah, so we, looking like it's going to be in Queensland next year, which is great. I'm from the Mornington Peninsula, so I could do with a bit more sunshine. And we haven't yet locked in any speakers or anything like that, but I think the focus is very much going to be on supporting our members, providing some informative talks on different facets of running a distillery, as well as some industry keynote speakers. So who they'll be, we're not yet sure. You know, there's always that informative element of the conference, which is so useful. But then there's the social element. And that's, you know, you have the conversations with your fellow distillers. We are still a really open and sharing industry. And I always can learn new things from my peers whenever I get deep into conversations with them about aging and distillation. And so just that networking element as well is, you know, I feel like that's just as important of a reason to go to the conference. So definitely encourage anyone thinking about it to get a ticket when they're released. But yeah, we're already starting to plan how to make next year's conference even bigger and even better.
Wonderful. Well, Holly, thanks so much for taking the time to have a chat. And yeah, congratulations again on becoming the president of the ADA, the first female president of the ADA. And yeah, look forward to working with you over the next few years.
Thank you, James. Great to chat with you today. Thanks for having me.